This is Jan Cox, talk number 1290, recorded on June 1st, 1994.
Going to reread just a couple from last time and see if they do not tie in. Guess I'll make them. Simple minds disagree, which collectively is how the simple minds eventually become more complex. The few who would be true individuals can't wait that long. Remember, if you're surrounded by agreeable, like-minded passengers who, same as you, go moo, you're not on an excursion tour, but on a cattle train, which also infers, I could have put it, you're on a slaughter train. You're on the way to the stockyards. Next paragraph, Father, is this why knowledgeable birds of a feather wouldn't stick only together? Only together. Quite so, my boy, and also why the routine-minded find the transcendental trip so disturbing and uncomfortable. Anomalous aviary addendum. The ordinary mind knows what it likes and likes what it likes. Why do you think it's known as the partisan mind? And routine men's resignation to thinking the thoughts of others is well represented by the dieter who, as he gobbled down some shoplifted candy, said to himself, if you didn't pay for it, it don't count. Seeing, pressing on to tie together the idea of the mystical and the absolute everyday way the mind works. As this has become, well, the things I've written publicly, and as this is now shown and seen all across the country, these tapings, there is some, I guess no small number, who find my comments, these comments, to be a criticism of the mystical. Some even go so far as to believe that I am engaged in an attempted kind of debunking of the mystical, that I am their kind of opponent, the kind of people that you would, but at any rate, those of you who've been around, you would know that, in a sense, it couldn't be further from the truth. That's what this is all about. And yet, think about this. I'm not just picking out two or three letters I might have gotten in crayon. This has been going on for some time now. What you would think would be the natural constituency of, let us just say that this is a kind of modern day. That can't be in question since we're all here alive. It is a modern day contemporary, or represents a modern day contemporary, let's try that, interest in things mystical, in the transcendental experience and journey, etc. And so the natural constituency is always there to some degree, as witnessed by the large Dewey Decimal System there on Dewey's nose right inside the library door. And yet, what I'm saying is not just one or two. There is a, amongst the communiques and things that's happened to me over the last few years when I'd show up publicly, people who will show up and listen or read books or watch these tapes, but then they, without any hesitation, take it as me, as the comments being a criticism, and as I said, even an attempt to in some way unravel, to show up, to expose the mystical. And how much further could it be from the truth? I bring it up not to, as you know, or you should know, to comment on me and what this is going on, because it has to do with how the transcendental, that which goes against or beyond partisan thought, beyond the ordinary workings of the mind, the difficulty it is of people unraveling it or even hearing it. First little footstep there coming out of or into the pool, according to whether it's spring or summer in your head, should be the fact that I point out that the very constituency, if people have some notion that if I showed up to speak or if they watch these tapes, they don't seem to have any doubt that it has to do with things mystical. And then they listen and listen. And then a not unsizable number of people listen to it, but hear it as being some sort of criticism, some kind of, if not outright opposition, that in some way I'm attempting to expose, to pull up mysticism's dress, or to, you know, to point out that it's naked, or to have to requote, to be redundant. They actually see it as some form of attempted debunking. You can figure out what that would amount to, but it has to do with the workings of the mind itself. I was going to jump back to what we were talking about last time, about how the mind will impose order. It has to impose order, and order can only come about through a process of selection, which process of choosing, which is another way of expressing the partisan mind, another way of psychologically expressing that which is physically based, the dynamics of energy. Not that it's only possible waves, the dynamics of energy here that's ordinary and visible, operating on a in a three-dimensional context, and ends up in the physical, in the psychological realm, the mental realm, as a form of polarized partisan thinking. Selection, or else thinking will not work. You cannot get started. You cannot take your first step out of the silent paradise of Eden. You cannot step into the world of civilization. You cannot step into the world of actually being man rather than just Homo sapien who has a better hairdo than the orangutans, maybe. I said maybe. We were mentioning some of the ways in which I was trying to pull out a very specific example, that you would take people who are interested to whatever degree in ideas that apparently are the transcendental, mystical, non-standard, exotic, esoteric, occult nature, which vis-a-vis ordinary life are somewhat unstructured. That would be one of the operating definitions, whether they used it or not, of how you'd go out and find something mystical, even if you had just starting off and you had heard that mysticism is always lurking about or is the actual core of all religion. Then it would take you a very short period of time to go to all the organized sources of religion and find out that they're not interested in exactly what you are. And so then you would come to a very quick conclusion, if it had not already been suggested to you through the written word, if nothing else, that it's hidden. So you would know it is separate. You would not expect it after that struck you that, well, yeah, I should have known that. I mean, this is some sort of organized activity. This is something public. And if you had, let's just say that you've read in a book, somebody, whether they knew what they're talking about or not, said that the thing's mystical, if there has been some line of secret knowledge, if the ideas of Adam and Eve and the tree of knowledge, for instance, if that were something other than just a religious myth, then it has to do with a passing along of some knowledge, and then you find out, well, the very ones that would seem to be the protectors of it show no interest in it, organized religion. And so you would not be surprised then if someone said what you've got to look for is somewhere outside the structured, organized activities of the institutions known as religion. That you and be prepared to be, have your spiritual, if not intellectual, feathers ruffled, because you will probably not going to find anyone as decent and as clean-shaven and clean-cut and stable and charitable as your local priest or rabbi. You understand? So if you would think, I should have known that. And then you would be a prime suspect, just to carry on other random examples, it doesn't matter what, but if you start reading about wild Hindu gurus living in forest or Zen masters that sit around and look very intelligent until you ask them a question, they go, and you go, I should have known it. That people, that already, the point being that the mind will expect or it will accept as soon as it hears it, that if there is something mystical, if there is some sort of mystical activity going on in the world, you're not going to find it in a place where it's organized and regimented. I'm not saying whether that's true or not. If you heard that, which is a common story, if you read that and you'd gone that far, you would go, yes, that's got to be true. Then the example I was using last time was even those that pursue it any further. Even after they would buy the story, after they would accept the principle that if there is some mystical activity going on somewhere, it is not going to be as organized, as predictable, as stable as your local church or synagogue. All right, I got that. If they go further, they will, without any hesitation, because it's not psychological, it's not individual, they will, on top of that, begin to impose a new level of order. In that, I was using an example that they believe. If you read just beyond what I described that this, our fictitious old person read about mysticism, if you read beyond an introductory book on mysticism, like, how about a book on introductory mysticism? That's not good. If you got past that point and you got into a more advanced book, or you thought your ears were getting more advanced than your eyes. You would then hear stories like the one I was bringing out, that there is, in fact, a core within the secret core, as witnessed by the stories, whether you knew them or not. They've been around a long time. They're not as commonly known because you have to, even at the ordinary level, your mind has to go even further. You have to get past the point of the comfortable stability of organized religion, for instance, or any organized institution, any sense of order, which is a working definition also of civilization itself. To get past that and to buy the story, be ready to accept the principle that if there is something extraordinary going on, you're not going to find it in places that are non-extraordinary. You're not going to find them down at the bank. You're not going to find them at the local church, synagogue. You're not going to find them at a university. Anywhere that you go into, that if you walk in dressed up funny or burping or drunk and they say, shh, you know, you can't do that here, then you can assume they don't know anything. But they're not interested in mystical matters. If they are, they're not interested right then. And for those of you good, since you're reacting, all institutions, to all institutions, whatever is now is right then. See, you understand? Well, in case you didn't, when I was trying to give them sort of a way out, if you go in acting strange, if you, you know, stormed into a church and hollered, all right, how do you get born before you die? I read about that. Now, how do you do it? You know, a priest or somebody, a nurse, somebody's going to say, sir, we don't act like that in here. And so, no, right now we're having mass. We're having a meeting. You say, well, when can I do that? You know, when can I do it? That's why I mean they're going to go, well, I don't know. You know, check with us later. There is no time for instability. There is no time for disorder in civilization. And hence, there is no time for disorder within the subcontext, within the subsets of civilization, which is why we have laws against crime and disorderly conduct and other small hobbies that some people have. But even had you already accepted the idea that if there is something extraordinary going on, if there is some passage of some sort of secret knowledge going on, it will not be within the forums, will not be within the buildings, the institutions of known, recognized subsets of civilization. So you'd be prepared to hear that it goes on in an unstructured environment. It goes on such as one old guy with no clothes on, never shaves. He's living in the woods in India or Tibet. That you just have to go out there. You have to find him. And you know, he may or may not talk to you, or you have to go join up, find a real monastery somewhere with some real Zens, find the ones that won't admit they're Zen, then they probably are, and then be prepared, though, to ask them a serious question, and all you get the rest of your life is non sequiturs, and you're supposed to go away and make sense out of it, and you read that and go, I'm ready, that's it, I believe it. That would have to be it, compared to what I've already observed here in the city. But after that, if you go any further, the mind will, on top of that, after believing, after accepting that there's a secret core beyond this stable, middle-class, collective reality of religion and all these civil, decent organizations, that there's some secret core somewhere, if I can just find it, that, and you're already prepared to accept that it's going to be unstable. That's one reason that people will suggest it's hard to find, because they do not have signs out, they don't have buildings. And in fact, they may deny it if you find them. That's one of the great stories. Armchair mystics seem to rediscover that one like every 22 years, like it's a brand new thing, that somebody will come out with a book and say, I've discovered one thing in my world travels. It's when you find a real Sufi or a real Zen or a real mystic, one way you can tell. I mean, everybody can tell you, so-and-so's one if you can just find him. He's the guy with the red beard. He's naked. You can't mistake him because of such and such scar. You'll know him when you see him. And also, but don't bother to say, aren't you so-and-so? Because if you ask him that, he'll deny it. And so I've learned that one way you can tell a real mystic is, he'll deny it. And people sit there in their armchairs reading, they lay down their pipe, and they go, my God, that's great. How deep. And then they just know it's true. It's just another sign of the kind of disorder, a kind of, what it would amount to, if that's all it was, would be a kind of harmless rebellion against predictable, ordinary order. But they think that would be great, that they would deny it. So there you have a great example of disorder. That if you found the secret core, the difficulty be that they won't admit it, what could be more disorderly? I mean, that's verging on insanity. And what will people do past that point, though? If they have any interest beyond that, they will, in fact, impose order, which I was bringing you up to the stories, whether you knew them or not, that within the, if you had an idea, I'm just speaking about someone in a fictitious third person, if you had an idea of a worldwide tradition of it being, whether it was hidden in Buddhism or Islam or whatever, some combination, there is, are these stories not quite as popular because you have to go further than that kind of armchair, esoteric thinking. You have to sit there and then imagine or hear the stories that they even get together and they actually have a stable core within the unstable core that is within the external stable core. And I was mentioning that there is a story that's not quite that well known that they get together every 100 years or so. And they actually, in some way, select among themselves. Like, this is the keeper of the keeper. This is the key to all keys. This is the key among us other keys. There are also other stories that you may or may not know. Probably, since this is here in the Western world, some of you may have heard the stories because it's easier when you look across the fence. It's easier to hear the stories if it apparently has to do with someone else's religion or someone else's culture. And one that's probably not as well known to you, there are lingering stories taken quite seriously by a few people that Jesus, for instance, had children. And there's even, there are people right now who believe that there is a living male descendant right now in Europe, that some people have his name, they know who he is. They believe that, and of course, as some of you know, all the stories, the myths of all the way from a different version of the Holy Grail of someone actually has a vial with Jesus' blood in it, stories that may be better known to you, looked at from other religious, from other areas, is the bones, the artifacts, but actual bones, fragments of bones, were sent out after Buddha died, and they were sent to 12 great centers across the planet wherein the teaching would go forth. And since then, they've been split up even more. And every time a new serious school opens somewhere, the point is, it represents. Now, ordinary people that read such as that, even if they took it seriously, to them it is verging on fairy tales. Or it's back verging on organized religion. They're just a little more interesting. It's the kind of thing that you wouldn't hear at your weekly Baptist meeting in Jackson, Mississippi. But what it represents is the idea of an unbroken passage of some sort of secret knowledge, slash sometimes, and power. That there is something that is potentially, or those who believe in it, not potential, there is something quite real, and they even have names for it, that some of them, they say your name's supposed to say the name, but there is a power, for instance, to someone who has a piece of the cross that Jesus, well, I should be more specific. That's pretty small time. If you had a piece of Buddha's bone, if you had yourself some of the actual blood of Jesus, the cross, you can buy that from guys in Mississippi. Well, it used to be, it was a cross, it was over at the Wolfman Jack station down in Del Rio. The station was called Del Rio. It's down in Mexico, but you could order the pieces of the cross until someone didn't do any good, but figured out the rate they'd been selling those little pieces of the cross. And at the rate they'd been selling them, that, you know, it ended up that the cross on which Jesus was crucified, if this was indeed a piece of it, was something like the size of the Empire State Building. But obviously just a sore head. Somebody came up with that. And they're just sorry he didn't think of it. But back to something more specific. I didn't mean to distract you that much. It would not be just the cross. It wouldn't be just the actual chalice that called the blood. It would have to be a physical contact. Now, these stories are everywhere. It is in Taoism. It is in no-name shamanic beliefs of all kinds of tribes all over the world that they had some founder that almost distinguishes what is a culture, regardless of what anthropology says, but some group of people that believe that they had a founder, that they had their own Abraham, that they had their own original turtle, which is was like the support of the Chinese universe. But anyway, they had their own Abraham, allegorically speaking. Every time they believe that, anytime you find a group that is still that cohesive, no matter how large or small, it could be just some, let's say, fairly small number of people in Mongolia, there and knows that. If they believe, if we find this one subgroup and they believe, and there was, you know, some name, Arkman, eons ago was the founder, that in some way, and there'll be a little story that the gods touched him, or there was a meteor came down and hit there in the frozen tundra of the area, and from it grew a flower, and from the flower grew Arkman, and since then, pieces of him. Then he died, and he blew up like an exploding planet, and that everybody in the tribe at the time got a piece of him, whoever has a piece. The point being, again, now they could take it, you might get there, and the people now walking around maybe holding little rocks, and they got them tied around their neck, and you could say, what a bunch of superstitious rot. And they go, I've got to hold this. You know, protects me from demons. And he's like, pfft. And someone can say, it's even more than that. It is actually our connection to the founder of the universe, which they mean the founder of what we consider to be our universe. But what it really represents is where religions came from also. In that one sense, is it is representing an unbroken line of something. And when it gets into the area that ordinary people would call mysticism, it is then specifically to the point that if there is a secret school going on, or if they have one in mind, if they believe whatever, that inside of Buddhism of some particular sect somewhere, or in some of the dervish schools or some of the Christian monasteries, whatever it is, and they believe that it is still the keeper of some sort of secret knowledge if you just get in there. What it represents is, and all the myths that go along with it, is it represents an unbroken chain because it wouldn't count. How could you depend on it if indeed, say, a Buddha actually understood everything about the universe, just understood it all, and that in some way not just taught, because it has a ring of something. I'll get to it in a minute. I'm not laughing at it. It is not just superstitious. It'd be one thing to say, all right, if we assume that he was the greatest man mentally, spiritually, that ever lived, and you go, okay, and he taught these 12 monks with him, yeah, and then they taught some, yeah, yeah, and so they kept it quite pure. Forget what he said out in public. He taught them something, just exactly what he knew. No fooling around, no nothing. He just told them, and they passed along. But then there was a war came along, a famine, or they had trouble. And as far as we can tell, it's just an accepted fact among those who now take it, who are now keepers of the flame, that for like one generation it disappeared and then they kind of put it back together. A real would-be mystic, even an armchair mystic, won't accept that. Do you hear me? In other words, if there was actual knowledge, if Adam, if Abraham, if Muhammad, if Buddha had the secret in some way, got plugged into the universe, some way, whatever the story was, and he knew what life was about, and he told somebody, and we know who he told. He told his son, you know, Sam, and then Sam told Fred, and Fred told Bob, and then Bob didn't have any children. You know, it was an unfortunate accident. A horse kicked him. He couldn't have any kids. But at any rate, there, in some way, even the people who are trying to follow this, who are interested in that line, if they say, well, there seems to be no doubt the secret teaching dropped out for X number of years. 10 years, 20, anyway, it disappeared for some time, but, and they picked it back up. Somebody put the pieces back together with some notes left here and there, and they found it in his trunk after he died 20 years later. It may come to something enough that they can work up some sort of cult around it, but it will not fit into that real mystical tradition. It has to be. That's what the myths represent. That's what I would suggest to you all in the Western world, the myths of chivalry, and all the other side of the world, the samurai myths, all of these great efforts, but it was always a king being, and something being protected. And then warriors come along, and then another generation. It was either that, or if you look at it as being religion, it is always an unbroken line of something being passed along. Now, you would think at first, well, this would do it if we just talk about Buddha taught so-and-so, or Abraham taught his son, they taught it, and they all came on down. All right, that's one thing. But again, and they do not have to be fanatics. We're not talking about people who are necessarily so wild-eyed that they're not regular members of society, is what I mean by armchair mystics. They can hear that and go, well, yeah, I guess that's sort of what the church says about the Pope, the Catholic Church. As they don't, at least publicly, they don't make any physical claim, because it's no doubt they get together and elect the Pope. But it's supposedly there's some spiritual power that's been passed along all this time, that there is an unbroken chain of popes, but they're not the sons of the former Pope. There is no physical passing along of something. They can infer, or you could infer, if you were attempting to conjure up a picture of mysticism within organized Catholicism, then you could conjure up a picture of that there is some secret knowledge, and each pope tells the next pope, or if he dies suddenly, at least the College of Cardinals, the people around that's going to select the next one, they know it, they're all put together. In some way, they know it. That almost flies, but here's what I'm getting at, almost. It is something else than to hear. There's some people who are actually descendants of Abraham. Not fooling around, not somebody saying, well, yeah, I'm a Jew, so I'm from Abraham. Or a guy saying, well, yes, I'm Indian, and hell, why not? I could be a descendant of Buddha. That's like saying that everybody, if you go back far enough, everybody's a descendant of King George. I know that bothers some of you who take seriously those cards you hold that say that since the treatments that you are now legally sane. I know, but... And it would be something else, well, before I get to that real specifically. Even those that would believe that there would be or could be an unbroken chain of the passing of knowledge, if they hear the story, and again, they do not have to be certifiably or on the verge of being certifiably unstable, but if they just hear that the stories, the rumors, the legends, that people, somebody say the blood of Jesus, and especially the story now, the ritual of the Eucharist, that originally what he was doing was not pouring out a little wine and saying, well, let this, when you drink this, remember it in recollection of my great ideas and what I did, that they actually drank part of his blood and was a passing along of something. Forget this idea of some theoretical knowledge. It was a passing along of something quite real. It turns out as knowledge, but it was something specific. Or some people really got pieces of his bones, such as with the Buddha. And that if you have one of the pieces of the bones and you're the right person, you've got to be the right person, of course. If somebody just lost it and you picked it up, it might not work. But if you're the right person, there is something possible with having the blood of Jesus, with having the bones of Buddha, that there is something that is beyond any description, and this something is the basis, the physical, the real material basis of the idea of some unbroken chain of knowledge / power being passed through humanity, and that you can see it in all the stories from all the world of all their own Adam and Eve stories. And then every one of them has a story after the fall, after the separation from God, after the moment of creation, those that seem not to be that much of a deific-centered religion or like the Vedic scriptures. It's still an idea that in some way there's this big boom, and then that man is sort of spread out, and he's lost from the center, that he's separated from the center. Things expand out, and man is no longer at the beginning of where he was. The Adam and Eve story is one of the great ones that God just says, go out and get away from me. You made me mad. Go away. You're grown up. Go take care of yourself for a while. So they all have a story, some version of that. Then they have a story. In other words, that seems to be the man is now in a lesser position, or he is cast off somewhat on his own devices, and he needs help. And then they all come back with a story of a savior. That is a Western term that I was open to some discussion if you want to look at from different languages and other areas of the world, but it's what it amounts to. Somebody came along to help. After Buddha died and it actually split up into schools, that is one of the big factions of the school, is whether Buddha was a savior or not, because half the Buddhist schools in general, say there's nothing to be saved from, so he wasn't a savior. That's impossible. And that the whole idea of nirvana or being enlightened is not to save you from something, unless you want to call being saved from delusion, maybe. But even that, the real strict ones, they said, no, you can't be saved from delusion, because delusion doesn't exist. I guess it makes some long nights of them sitting around drinking coffee at Denny's, like, well, where we go from here? But anyway, they have a story that someone comes along. And the someone who comes along, whatever the description is, what it amounts to, is they then teach something having to do with one way or the other with a rebirth of a going back to somewhere resembling being driven from the garden, somewhere after the big bang explosion of Brahma going, for this period of 330,000 million years, and man kind of goes into one of the molecules, and before he sucks it back in, is he sends out some kind of help like, wait, here's some new information. You could almost go back to where we started and be reborn before the whole time of death, physical death. That has a certain striking impact on those who are interested in metaphysical, mystical matters, and even on historians, even on anthropologists who are not necessarily active in it, that they do actually get and try to trace the stories of a vial of Jesus' blood. And they may not be religious. It just, something gets them. The something that gets people is this. Karma is not, to use that idea, or the life after death, a rebirth. And although Christianity, I know the Western world denies sort of collectively the idea of karma, that is, of being reborn and having to keep living out your life, they're just playing with words. It's just simple-minded people, because that's exactly what all religion, including Christianity and Judaism and everything else. If they believe in an afterlife, they believe in reincarnation and karma. They can deny it all they want to, and it's just to help separate the American League from the National League. It's just to separate rugby from soccer. That's all it is. At any rate, that what you do is going to affect the rebirth. Except they mean the rebirth. Now we're speaking about organized religion, the collective view. They're speaking about the rebirth of actual after physical death. But now if we talk about something else, the idea of karma, and tied to, if you'll stick in the connection yourself, between this unbroken line of secret knowledge, the handling, the ownership of Buddha's, a piece of Buddha's actual skeletal structure, some of Jesus's actual blood, that to have it is to have some sort of power, if that's what you want. If you had any idea what it was up to, that's more than just being able to read supposedly the words of Jesus or of Moses or of Muhammad. Tied to the idea of karma, you understand by now, the whole idea of karma is not your past deeds. It's not determined by deeds. It's one thing and one thing only. All of this is one thing. Genetics. All right, try it. Try it another way. Not a completely other way, but if I may be so bold as to speak for some people, I do know that sometimes it is so point blank in your face when I get to the punchline. And then many times I make little jokes like, well, I expected better than that. I could be lying. I may have gotten what I wanted, and I may be exaggerating for dramatic purposes when it gets real still. And I go, well, boy, all that trouble for nothing. I don't mean it was nothing, but sometimes notice things. I can call it point blank. You can call it anything you want to. Sometimes I'll get to the punchline of something, and those of you who do see it, there is no reaction. You don't necessarily laugh or go, oh, my God. It's just, and many times not even that. Many times you sit there, and I see you, and you're doing about what I am. It's just a deadpan delivery, and you take it as a deadpan acceptance. Consider, and I'll remind you again, we are not at the heart of this talking about Jesus or Buddha or not even individual people. Because men have to take, ordinary minds do eventually take a Buddha, which you could look at it mythically if you know anything about it, right? You could take Buddha as being a myth regarding secret knowledge or the knowledge of the universe, the knowledge of life is what he represented. The whole idea of enlightenment. The whole idea of being reborn in the Christian sense, but the Buddhists, even their translations into English are a bit more pithy, and sometimes it's easier to use if you get away from your cultural background. But you can see Buddha, the Buddha, our Buddha, as being a mythical allegory for the knowledge of life, or this secret knowledge. But ordinary minds will take, they did in his case, let's put it, stick with that, have now turned it into an object of worship. They have turned Buddha, if you took it as being a verb, as a process, Buddha is not a person. And in spite of the fact that there is, I'm just using their descriptions. I'm not telling you whether it's right or wrong or whether I know different or better. But there is, it is accepted within the general canons and history of India and specifically even Buddhism, where it's noted that Buddha almost, he did everything but say that he didn't believe in God as they did at the time. I say believe, of him telling the people, you know, forget all that. He did everything but tell them there is no God, not like you're believing right now, circa 500 B.C. He did everything but that. And by some accounts, they've tried to interpret that. They said, well, he obviously didn't believe in God. I mean, it's obvious. Here it is. We've got thousands of pages and people that talked to him all those years. And after he was once enlightened, after he admitted that he knew what was going on, he stuck around for another 40 years and talked. And not one time in the midst of all this, did he ever say anything about God under any name. So there's your proof. Again, look at it not as a person, but as that Buddha, the one who didn't speak of God, not as a person, but as a form of knowledge, that the knowledge at the time didn't speak of God, didn't speak of some extrinsic force to which we must in some way obligate ourselves, submit ourselves, that was not looking for power from without. Because if there's anything that Buddhism represented, again, not as a religion, but the Buddha as an idea, as a secret knowledge, was that there is no outside help. Not if you want to know what I know, if we're looking at Buddha as being the secret knowledge, not if you want this, don't look for outside help because it's not out there. I've already proven that, said he. I went out and I pursued all the religions you got. I got so good that those who were the leaders of religion began to look to me and say, what do you think? That they took me not just as a peer, but now as their superior. And I'm telling you, it amounts to nothing. Or it's not, it will not give you the secret. And he pointed out, I did everything that they do. I starved myself. I stuffed myself. I went without sex. I went with sex. I stood up. I laid down. I grew a beard. I showed my head. That wasn't it. That the power, the secret, is not without. It's not out there. There is no outside help. There is no outside enlightenment. There is no outside direction. Not of an extraordinary nature. If there is, then it's within you. That exemplifies this idea of an unbroken, secret knowledge that's hidden. Because he already pointed out everything that was known at the time, and it's still right up to date, all the rituals, all the religions, all the beliefs, all the way from naturalistic religion all the way to what was growing or whatever the religions considered were of India at the time, that he said, that's not what it is. And he did not speak of religion at all, of God. Change horses right quick again and look at religion, Buddha as not being a person, but as a process, as a verb of the secret knowledge itself. The secret knowledge made no reference to God. And it's accepted by many authorities now that, in fact, he did not believe in God. That's what I'm getting to. And so now what do you have within a short period of time? He is now an object of worship. He is taken as being a literal person, and maybe it was. So I just said for a while, there for a second, take it as being not a person but as a process, that Buddha represented the secret knowledge. That Buddha was not a person. Buddha was like a word for it, the secret knowledge. But even if he was a person, and if we take their word now, the historical word, the interpretations, they're accepted as fact that he didn't believe in God. But now look. Now that is a matter of non-order. That is a matter of being out of order in any society for someone not to believe in God, whatever their God is, because that strikes at the heart of order, which is the synonym for civilization. So the man would be completely out of order to have some kind of large following like Buddha supposedly did and say, oh, by the way, there is no God. You don't forget all this stuff about being civil and being moral. That's what they say, almost, that he was that bad. At least he said there is no God. He, in essence, represented the idea that there is no God. So now what is he? He is an object of worship. That which is the mythical truth, that which would be this unbroken line of reality, must turn into literal historical fact. or men will not even remember it. They will not even acknowledge the fact that there may be some unbroken sequence to life beyond the physical. There's no doubt there's a physical, because you look around and there's your great-grandmother still alive. Or your grandmother tells you about your great-grandmother. Or you see photographs of your grandmother. You see the headstone, and you know that somebody buried the person there. So you know there's that sequence. But then it seems to be not quite as certain that there is an intellectual, even though they might want to call it spiritual, kind of sequence. That it seems to be a continual, and especially the older you get. And if you're past 21, you're getting older. We've already been through that. There seems to be a kind of gapping there, that the orderly, safe feeling of being alive that you had when you were a kid or a teenager, that went along with that kind of sense of urgency that I can't hurry to grow up, and I'll do something because I know I got talent. I play my guitar, and my mother loves it, and so I know I'll be famous. I'll get there, and I can see what so-and-so did, and what I know just how to be famous and get and have fun with life, and you get past the point, get to the top of the hill, and the hormones begin to slow, you become grown, you become part of the establishment. You become a religion. You become a civil organization yourself. And you begin to lose a sense of urgency. When you do that, you individually, though you do not initiate it, you then become part of the collective need to take that which was originally a mythical idea, that which was originally a non-physical continuation of this knowledge, and turn it into a literal fact. I guess I kind of slaughtered that. Well, the way I originally had it, but I didn't read it, was that as the mind ages, it will take that which was mythical and will turn it into literal fact. It's not some sort of accident. It's not that maybe the mind will. Not yours just individually, but collectively. It's why every civilization, every culture has some sort of religion, has some sort of cultural history that they believe that they had a founder. There was either the founder of their religion, the founder of their race, the founder of their culture, a founder of their little tribe. But they are taking that which was the myth. I guess I'll eventually get around to giving you what I mean by myth, but I assume you know that I don't mean just a myth. But they must take that which would be the kind of unstable, disorderly, non-physical line of this knowledge, which is not physical, but they have to turn it into literal fact to make it look physical. And is one reason I would suggest also that humanity has reverence for the dead. Now, you can talk about how much we should revere our grandparents and all that stuff, but think about it. Why do we put up monuments to the dead? Why do you go out to the cemetery and look? Doesn't mean that you didn't love your mother, your grandmother, but why? Why? And don't get all involved with fine-sounding anthropological and sociological descriptions, because all they are is fine-sounding bullshit. And we've already established that. Why do men do that? It was for the reason I was hinting a few minutes ago. It gives a sense of some sort of order. What is history? Why do men love to, even the dunderheadedest among us, love to keep saying, well, we must know our history, because if, here we go, if we don't know where we came from, we don't know where we're going. Or the other variation, if we don't know our history, those who do not learn from our history are doomed to repeat it. Boy. And some people say there's no such thing as mass enlightenment. I am suggesting, amongst other reasons, that that is man's reverence for the past, even though I'm also suggesting that it is not necessarily based upon any individual reality, because what good does it? It doesn't matter whether you love your mother, but what good does it do to go out there and stand there and cry? What good does it do to even think about it? To think about my poor father, the way he died with cancer right there at the end, and to keep every day thinking about how raggedy he looked, and he was just in mortal pain, just horrible. And you keep doing that. Why? It is not recognized, certainly, as such. But it is the same reason that Buddha is not turned into an object of worship. It is the same reason that we remember history, that we write it down, even those who failed it in high school. you would admit, you would have to if you're sane, if you know very little history. And somebody says, well, history is important, even if you're not interested in it personally, because we need to know what went on. Civilization is kind of held together. It's anchored down by there being some kind of historical precedent for what we do, or the rituals we do religiously or here civilly. I mean, there's some power to it. And they're right. But they got the wrong power. I didn't actually mean to golf on that, but as long as I'm there, I'm not just poking fun at that. For them to say, well, there is a sense of power for us to get together collectively and to go back and revere some great tribal victory. When our tribe defeated the other tribe 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and now every year, the leaders of the tribe, the leaders of the city, they get together and put on sashes and hats and robes and knives, and they shoot guns, and they stand, they get silent, and they look up. Now, you could say, well, that's kind of silly. You know, if you're just saying that's a waste of time, they could say, no, it has a power. In the same way, you could walk into a church, especially when you're a church, and you find out, well, they're going through this ritual, drinking the wine, and they're saying that they're actually drinking the blood, and somebody getting in some kind of allegorical connection to the founder of their religion, to the revealed one who gave them the secret of life or told them how to be reborn after you die. And you could go, that's ridiculous. I mean, what the hell does that mean? You're missing it. There is a power to it. It's a collective power. It won't do you any good. That's why you don't find mystics in churches or synagogues or in the armed forces, if they can help it. I don't know that. I just said that to make you draft dodges feel easier. Because nowadays you're in pretty good company, aren't you? A little political humor. There is a power to... I want you to see right quick, I got sidetracked. When I was saying that for an individual mystic, the whole idea of revering the dead, not that you should not revere the dead, but the whole idea of in some way that the dead are worthy of some great interest, especially my family, but then even in a vaguer sense that our forefathers, there are plenty of people that will stand up and almost get a tear in their eye when they see in the United States, for instance, when they see that painting of our founding fathers signing the Constitution. And they just, you know, their little heart gets, and they say, well, it just, and it's not just funny. There is a power to that, but the power is kind of misplaced from an individual sense, because what it does is give the collective some sense of order, some sense of this continuity. Put it to you real point blank. The idea of patriotism, nationalism, family loyalty, that is all a crude version of the unbroken line of the secret knowledge of what life is. It's the best that ordinary people can do. It's the best they want to do. You don't have to say, well, I just said it was the best they can do. It's not just, well, they're all dumb, because we could say, well, wait a minute. If you're going to say they're dumb and they could be more involved with this, then why aren't they here? The door's not locked. So it's not just that they can't do it. Nobody wants to do it. They're not interested in that. And so their purpose is served just in the same way that, back to where we started tonight, if indeed there is a secret teaching, a secret knowledge in general in all the great religions, if that was what the original flame was, and it's still around, if that be true, then organized religion is not some form of stupidity. It just became all they wanted to deal with. It became all they wanted. And after that, it's nice to say, well, yeah, but there's more. And maybe some guy right there in church or synagogue, and he's got nothing else to do, and maybe he's heard a little about it. And he says, really, where? You go, well, I hear there's a group over right outside of Baghdad, right outside of New Delhi. And the guy goes, huh, really? Yeah, I've read stuff like that sometimes. You think there's really going on? And you go, yeah, I really think it is. They go, boy, that's interesting. And it's supposed to be it's actually what Moses said originally. It's what Jesus really passed along. Yeah, that's what they say. And there are people over there that they say that it's really would kind of shock you, that would really reveal and unfold what Christianity or Judaism or whatever you're doing, what it really is. And they go, oh, boy, that is interesting. Well, I got to go. It's not because they're stupid, because they could go, well, do you have the address? I think I'll go. They could go if they wanted to. It is and I'm saying crude and simplistic, not as a pejorative statement, but religion nationalism, the whole sense of history, is a kind of simplistic, or put in another way, all that's necessary, all that ordinary people want, version of this unbroken line, if it exists, of some kind of knowledge of what life is. But the mind must, rather than deal with that, ordinary minds, I say must, they do, so you can use do or must, they will turn the myth of it, or the allegory of it, into literal fact. And thus a Buddha, and thus an Adam, turns into a real person. It then turns into a real fact that there was actually a man called Adam, and the secret knowledge, God, got mad at him. And this actually happened. And so that's why we're cursed. That's why now we don't know what's going on. We're sort of at sixes and sevens, although no one can explain what the hell that means either. But that's the British for you. I don't even want to go into that. I can explain almost how anything on this planet exists. Except being British. And don't write me because I do not have a vested interest in attacking our Anglo-Saxon brethren. At any rate. They can then, once it turns into an actual story, that a man called Adam existed and that he offended the gods, and therefore we're paying for it now because don't you kind of feel uneasy that you don't really feel satisfied? Everybody goes, yeah. He said, well, there you are. An ordinary person, that's as good a story as any. You think, so that's why no matter what I do, I just, somewhere inside, I don't feel right. That's it. That's exactly it. But then there'll be another Savior come if you're Jewish, or he's already been here if you're Christian. You know, he's already been here, and he told you what to do, told you how to live, so that after you die, then you won't be so upset next time around. That's all that the ordinary mind needs. That represents, on a large collective scale, that represents the history of man, the purpose of history, all the way from that to the individual, non-aware, non-thinking, but the individual, reverence, interest in, recollection of the dead. It is a crude, it is a simplistic, physical imposition on the idea of an unbroken string of knowledge, which I refer again to you, to your notice that the whole thing is genetic period anyway. They now impose a physical, external structure on it, such as history, the history of England, the history of Western civilization, the history of Eastern civilization, the history of the Chinese Empire, the history of the Indian culture, the Vedic culture, the history of whatever. And it serves a purpose, and it does have a power. It does have its own mystical power, in a sense, for someone to say, to pull themselves up, and this, when I say their heart beats and their get a tear in the eye, that they can stand there, be they religious or not, and they will choke up. They will feel a power, a damn near mystical power, at some sort of parade, according to who they are. That is, here goes the Catholic Church by. Here goes the German army, if you're German. Here goes the Italian army. Here goes just a group of rabbis marching by. Here goes a group of Tibetan sheep herders with a shaman in front holding up. Whatever it is, there will be something that a person, an ordinary civilized person somewhere, there'll be some piece of a parade will go by and they will feel a mystical connection to it, to the point that they want to salute, they want to stand at attention, or they want to bow their head. They will be touched because it has a mystical power down there. Because what it is a crude, simplistic, collectively available representation, reflection, version of this unbroken line of transcendental knowledge. It's hard to salute it. It's hard to get choked up because the way the mind works, it's hard to even see it. And especially if you realize that it's damn near impossible to see it externally, then finally, after maybe 40 or 50 years, you think, so that's why it's so hard to find. And then you might want to stamp your little foot and say, well, why didn't you tell me? And just before you got to tell me, then you would think, well, goddamn, you did. Consider where we've got to stop tonight. The idea, and there's as much validity to this as the damn near, as I put it, mystical power that one's sense of nationalism of culture, of race, their whole feeling about their own parochial culture, whatever, if they consider themselves, if they look at their real, just their family, their tribe, their race, their religion, whatever, that kind of mystical impact, or damn near mystical impact, it's their version of it, that kind of feeling, when I said it would be even stronger, if you can hear what I was suggesting behind the stories of having an actual piece of Buddha's bone, and being the right person, you always got to consider that. Of course, there are some stories, if you want, that says it doesn't matter if you're the right person or not. There's some splinter stories in there of people who accidentally got hold of some of Jesus's blood, that accidentally got hold of a piece of Buddha's bone. And I'm saying stories are taken quite seriously within a small group of peoples that pop up here and there all over the world, and very extraordinary events follow, which I will not go into the stories. But at any rate, normally you're supposed to be in some way prepared for it, worthy of it, desirous of it. You're supposed to be actually out there looking for it, as the stories go, of trying to track down the sword that pierced Jesus' side, or the grail that caught his blood, or the bones of Buddha. You're supposed to actually be looking for them. And then if you do find it, there's something extraordinary happens because of the physical contact, not because of a teacher, not because of some man who was taught by a man who was taught by, and go back 2,500 years and actually trace it to Buddha. And you think, well, that's good, because this has gone on from mouth to mouth, direct. There's something else. If you get hold of an actual piece of Buddha, now, but consider this, or the other one, not just the blood of Jesus, I said, some of you looked a little surprised, but there are stories that Jesus actually had children and that they were alive. And those of you that don't know, in Islam, there's no secret. In fact, they down there have fist fights on the public side sometimes about who is the reigning progeny of Muhammad. Because he wasn't any secret about him. He had plenty of them. And they've had their own internal unpleasantness as about that. But at any rate, if there was, to take ours, which would be a little more surprising to most of you, that if right now there was an actual descendant, with no doubt, of Jesus, that he actually had children, and here's one, we could trace him right back, and the guy's right here, and you were primed for that kind of interest in a potential mystical core to Christianity, and if there was such a person, I'm just giving you a quick fairy tale suggestion, and you met the guy, it's very likely that you would feel damn near mystical in his presence, in the same way that the collective might feel mystical when the cardinal popes go by, or when people go over there to Rome and see the pope actually come out. Or if you stand there and a brigade of army and the marching band of your country, and they fly, the flag goes by. That same kind of feeling. What I'm getting at is not just the verbal, not just the intellectual passing along of knowledge. There is this continuing story that if you in some way could get in the physical presence of Buddha's descendants, or Jesus' descendants, or get a piece of him, or some of his blood. But what is all of that? Genetics. It is all genetics. You know how you become a mystic? Is that unfair? Everybody knew that, didn't you? You had a mother or father that was a mystic, didn't you? I guess that spooked you enough. That's what spooky is. It's not very spooky. It is. Would anybody like to guess what, according to one group, what the living male descendant right now of Jesus, he's in Western Europe. Would anybody like to guess what he's doing for a living? I'm talking about some serious people. Take this quite seriously. Nobody wants to guess? Don't even answer. Because you're probably trying to think of something that you figure that me saying it's something absolutely scurrile, is like an attorney. It's not that, but that's probably what you're thinking, but you don't shout it out, because if you do, then you're kind of stuck with it.
That concludes this talk. Be sure to visit us at jancox.com, where you can search through 3,000 talks for topics of interest, or just leave us a message.